My name is Maxine Antiga. I'm from Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is more than 800 different languages, close to 860. The other Melanesian countries also have many languages. We have the smaller islands, Solomons and Vanuatu are Melanesian countries. We have the Micronesians, Polynesians. So, and islands of Papua New Guinea goes from 20 degrees to 26. Our highest mountain always has snow on the cap. Then we have the coastal areas and the islands. I'm not a scientist, but I learned everything about marine and biology and all this on the work. So I am an organizational psychologist. That's my background. Then I did some later studies in not-for-profit management so that I can help build the capacity of the not-for-profit managers, because a lot of people become managers because of the issues. So the work we are doing on the board, we are all volunteers, and we have full-time jobs. Our coordinator is the chief and then a politician in their local, in their country. But we're very passionate about the communities that we work with. Where our organization can reach out, as we're doing our work, there are also neighboring communities that we see that need help, and they're passionate and they're interested in the work that they are doing. Then we let them know that, okay, we have, let us know, let's talk about what you want to do. Then we can support you.
Maxine talks about how they teach mangrove rehabilitation methods.
That's in a place called Medeng in Papua New Guinea. They hang in the posters on the trees. They take the butcher paper to sit on the beach, and then they draw their map and they show it to everybody in the village. Doing the rehabilitation for mangroves. So they're transplanting mangrove seedlings from the nursery to the beachfront. So it's low tide. And when it's a high tide, then everything will be covered.
Maxine explains that sometimes the way to get trust is through very creative methods, like giving a special nut.
In Papua New Guinea and in the Pacific, we have to find a way to get into the community, and we have to follow the traditional protocol. Green, they're called bitu nuts. So those are the ceremonial nuts that we have to share and we have to chew in order to be welcome. So
she joins government officials with tribal leaders.
Because we want to work closely together with the government officials, so we encourage the community to work with them. So the government officials have come down from their offices to sit around there and meet with the people. Our famous Pari group, they started off with women when we first supported them, and now they have men participating, and then today they're including the people with disabilities. Another community that we supported cut the pegs and all this, and they're doing the... they're planting the seedlings. That's in the southern part of Papua New Guinea.
The specific species of mangroves used for rehabilitation in various areas is very important.
So in Papua New Guinea, we have 44 different species of mangroves. And I think they say that's the second largest in the world. So Indonesia has 45 and we have 44. So the government decided that in 5 years we're going to plant 5 million mangroves. We don't know how realistic that is. But for our communities, we got the scientists to study, and mangroves will not grow in the places where there were no mangroves. And so we plant mangrove where there used to be mangrove before, and then we plant the correct species that used to grow there. And then mangroves grow in zones. So you have certain species, certain main species that are growing right where the sea is. So they will always be in an area where there is water, and then you go a little bit up, and then that's a second zone there on the beach where water goes up and then comes down during high tide or low tide. And then right up on the dry land, you also have certain species that grow there in the dry place. They're planting a species that grows in water right in front. It's low tide, so it will always be in water. So because we have all those mangroves, and when we started talking about mangrove and climate change, it's very important for us, where do mangroves grow? They are trained to do simple monitoring. So first we say, okay, so you get the seedling, this is how you do the nursery, we are using all the traditional materials, this is how many days it has to stay in the nursery, and then you have to move it down closer to where they will be growing so that they are acclimatized. And then the next day we plant them. Make sure you're checking them every day until they have tree leaves. Then they are now ready to be on their own. And if the current comes and pulls it away, then make sure you replace it. So if it's high tide, there are pegs that are holding on to so that the current doesn't take it away.
Maxine explains how the different zones are matched with various types of mangroves.
We've also helped the community to do simple surveys on the uses of mangroves. So I said we have like 44 different species, but we identified three main ones according to the needs of the people. Okay, so the first ones are the ones that are growing out there by the sea, and they're mainly for protection of the shoreline and for fish to come and breed right there. So we talked to the communities and they said, oh, that's where the fish are, and we know that as long as they're there, the wave will not come and wash things away. Okay, then in the middle zone, you have those long straight ones that grow, and they're for building houses, building, making poles, making big fences, building shelters, so they are used for building materials. So the ones in the front have this spider-type roots, so they stand there and it goes down, okay? And then the ones in the middle zone, they just grow straight, and they're good for building houses. But those are the species that communities recognize and use. And then on the dry land are the ones that they use for firewood. So they say that it's really, it can light, and so they call it kerosene firewood. They're all equally threatened. Normally, the mangroves are meant to just stay intact, and so when they cut one down, and then when the waves come, then everything starts disintegrating. Everything is interrelated. And then we're also working with, there is seagrass, and then there is coral reefs, and all these are all connected. So we're talking about climate change. So when there is flood, then all the rubbish and logs and everything in the bush, it's going to be swept to the coast when there's these big floods. But mangroves are there and they act as trainers. And so all those big logs and rubbish and everything has to come, and then if the mangrove is intact, then they are all stopped. The big ones are stopped. And then you have the smaller ones that are going to pass through the roots of the mangroves. Then they come down to the sea, and then you have the seagrass. So seagrass are also acting as trainers at their level. And then when they do that, then the corals are safe. Then our fish continue to breed. Because corals are animals, tiny, tiny animals that are all put together that grow over thousands and hundreds of years. Thousands of them are clustered to give us those color and the beauty. And so if the mangroves are gone, then all the rubbish is going to come down. And so every little animal that makes up the coral, if something like harpoon that they throw to catch a little food that they can eat to survive. But when the mangroves are gone and all the dust come in, and the energy that they have, if they use the energy twice to get rubbish, then they die. So that's why they're so important. Everything is interrelated.
Maxine speaks of the challenge of getting six countries together to protect the biodiversity of the Coral Triangle.
As early as in the time of Charles Darwin, said that this is the Philippines, then this is the Solomons, and then we come all the way to Timor-Leste. So this is a triangle, so it's called a Coral Triangle. So it's the hotspot biodiversity for marine environment. And so in 2009, the president of Indonesia called all the leaders of these countries. There are six: Philippines, Malaysia, Timor-Leste, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and the Solomons. And so what's happening here is that when there is climate change, the marine life there is struggling to cope with it. In this region, they have a way to adapt and survive. And also at the same time, we recognize that it's a place where so many millions of people are depending for their livelihood. And so the six countries, it was a difficult relationship because the Pacific people have to be talking to the Asian people. So they had locked doors meetings without the media to try and sort this out and see how do we work together. And so they got the Minister for Environment from Australia to come and facilitate and make us become friends. And so these six countries are now working together. So they have a regional plan of action. And so when we're working on marine, then we all cooperate. And this came about after our locally managed marine network existed, before they came. So it kind of enhanced the work that we were doing. So it allowed community people in Papua New Guinea and in different parts of this area, and also the rest of the Pacific, because the rest of the Pacific are close by, so now they call them the Coral Triangle Pacific, because they are close by, so they have to be included. So that's why in the marine area, governments are cooperating when Coral Triangle Initiative was created. It was a call from the government of Indonesia, and then all the other governments came together, agreed, and they started working on that. For the first time in many years, the government is listening. Now we see the need to work together. So I wrote the Coral Triangle Initiative is working multilateral agreement among the six countries because we are part of the locally managed marine areas network, and the government recognized that the communities were getting organized, the communities were doing something for themselves, and we were coordinating that, so they asked us to share the learning. They said, if you can collect all this learning from the community and share it with us, then that's going to be really helpful. So the relevant government department, like the environment department, asked to come and work together with them. Like in many other countries, in Papua New Guinea, a lot of national NGOs will say that we're not working with you because then we're going to end up doing what you want us to do and we won't do these other things. Mm-hmm. Mainly those American-based ones like the Nature Conservancy, Wildlife Conservation Society, Conservation International and WWF, they've been trying to work with the government to influence policy. But because they're international and the village people, communities don't trust them and the government is not really sure, maybe if we, because we're Papua New Guineans and Papua New Guinea registered organizations, so maybe if we can bridge, something might happen. So we said, okay, we can do that. And then we got everyone together, everyone that is working in the marine area together, and we said, let's start doing the exchanges.
Laws are now being made to legally protect lands and provide sustenance for the people who depend on them.
The laws in Papua New Guinea only talks about big national parks and big wildlife management areas where you just close off everything. But in Papua New Guinea, we own land, like the other Pacific Islands. And also in other communities, even though they don't own land, but they live in that place and they fish there and they farm there. And so when we put the big parks, then it just becomes paper parks and nothing happens. So we have several communities and we can close off this whole table because we are subsistence and where are we going to get our food from? Because our food is coming from the sea or from the land. And so once it's turned into a park, then and then the national government people go away and we go and get our food and they have it. They say that, okay, we have conserved this amount of area, but they just have it on the paper. But we're cutting the trees and we're making our gardens and we're living our lives. So it was like not really meaningful. The locally managed marine areas was thinking maybe we should do this differently. So if this is my community, and if this is my area, then I decided this is where I go fishing. This is open reef for me to go fishing that is in danger of becoming extinct. Then in this area, we can fish every fish except that fish. We don't fish. Then this is the place where all the fish are gathering every season and laying eggs, so we're going to leave it, close it off for good. And so if you're another community and you do that, and if you're another community and you do that, and if you're blocking off 1 mile by one, and if the government has a set standard of maybe 10% of the whole area, whole country to be conserved, then we count the places that we're closing off. And then we just give them the total because it is closed off. And we make the laws in the community and then we follow that. So we know that the fish are gathering there and laying eggs and our fish are all there and this place is protected. And then maybe we can make a calculation of, okay, the certain fish is not collected, so there should be a way to calculate. Then we can give that so the government can add it to their 10%. So we started advocating for that. That's what the locally managed marine areas network was doing. And so we advocated for that. And then when the Coral Triangle Initiative came around, then we went and we said, okay, we can influence policy, learning from what the communities are doing. And the grassroots level are finding out that if we do this, then it's going to work. So they divided their place up and saying, we'll go fishing here, we'll close this off. So that's a map that they're sharing with the whole village. And then they're going to get the clan leaders to agree.
How does enforcement work?
We let the people go back into their own clans and they have to talk about, do we really want to do this? So it takes a while to do that. And then they will come up with their own local enforcement to say that if we see you catching fish in that area, then you're going to give this number of hours of community service. Or maybe you're going to kill a chicken or a pig or something. So then they have their own laws. But in our national law, there is a provision for the local level government to make laws. And it's recognized at the national level because there's a section that says in the national law called the Organic Law of Papua New Guinea, there is a section that says the lower governments can make laws concerning things that are important, so it doesn't restrict it. And so that allows like the states and the districts to make their own laws, and then it's accepted at the national level. But at the same time, our country recognizes the customary laws and their own rules, the good ones. Yeah, so we have some of the traditional laws have like payback killing. So that doesn't agree with the common law. So that is outlawed. But there is a traditional law that says if you do something wrong, then you kill a pig. So then you can kill a pig and then share it with everyone in the village. And because pig is really important for our ceremonial purposes, so that's really painful. If you're found breaking the law of your management area, and if you are asked to kill the pig, then that's going to be really painful. So after you do that, you learn your lesson, you never go into that place again. But also we have the provincial laws now being enacted under the organic law. So for the first time in the Pacific, but especially in Papua New Guinea, after that 30 years of independence, we gained our independence in 1975. We didn't look at the importance of how to manage these resources at the national level, even though the communities were doing that. We just put up parks and paper parks and paper wildlife management areas, which are good, but because I look at the community perspective, my argument is that it's not good enough. But people from the government will say, oh no, it's good. But we all different views, but we agree to work together. So now Papua New Guinea launched the first combined protected areas policy. And in one of that section, they recognized different types of management areas, and they even recognized, and they even wrote locally managed areas, and they defined it the way we wanted defined for the first time. So in this protected areas policy, they also talk about the parks, they talk about the wildlife management area, which have a lot of requirements which you have to fulfill, and then it has to be gazetted for it to be accepted. But the smaller areas, they couldn't accept them because you're not closing off the whole area, you're just doing these pieces. And so they thought the pieces will never work, but then now they have put it in there, and they have said locally managed marine areas, the requirements are not very hard. As long as the community follows the traditional methods to say that we're going to close off certain area, and then we can count those. So for the first time, they put that in. So we're really happy. And how did that happen? When they were going to do their policy meetings, we have the bureaucrats and the technocrats all sitting there, and we have our village people sitting on the other side. So they get up and tell their stories. And the stories found their way into the policy papers. So now we have connected.
Maxine talks about how the groups have to hold the government accountable.
We said that these people, they are set up by law. It's their mandate to deliver services to our communities. But because of corruption and because of maybe not enough skills and so many other reasons, because of the way their culture is in Papua New Guinea, you go to this government office and then you want to ask them for help for something, and because they're so structured in the little boxes and they can only do one thing, so they tell you to come back tomorrow. Because the person who's supposed to attend to you to give you the answer is either on leave or is on travel or is sick. They're not really helpful. Many big businesses are owned by foreign companies. Papua New Guinea only has small ones. But these people are here to either give service or exploit the people. And they're not for profit, maybe because we are not for profit people talking, so we thought that we are the best. We said we're not there to exploit people, we're there to help people. But we also recognize that all these three start causing conflict in the community because nobody's talking about their resources. Or when these people go, or even when we go, that they start saying, oh, what are we going to do about this? And that's when conflict comes. So we thought about, so how do we work together? And so let's find a way to cooperate with these people, all these people, to help our communities. If the place is not destroyed yet, then we can do the advocacy and do all the other things. But how about a place where they've already cut down all the logs and they planted oil palms and it's structural because the policy has supported them to come and plant their oil palm. And they've destroyed all the land. So we can't stay for all our lives complaining about it because at the first place we didn't do anything and the place is already taken. So then we have to go and find out and say, can you support this community which you already destroyed? So that's a different story from those that we're trying to protect. So that's the idea why we start working with everyone. And then we talk with the communities. Okay, here we can say no. The government already said yes, and they've taken things away, and we can't move it back because the place is all covered in oil palm. Okay, but where they're still coming, then we can stop them. And there are people who can stop them.
oil palm companies can be held accountable through the World Bank.
There are other organizations that are working with the World Bank because the World Bank funds them. And so they have started talking with the World Bank people and then holding them accountable and say, this is what your policies say, yet the oil palm company is doing this. So they were not leaving buffer zones. You're supposed to live like 100 meters from the coast or from the river, but they were just planting right near the river. Most recently, some of those companies that were not following the rules, they sold out to better companies. So now they are trying to work backwards to fix that. It's a slow process and a long process, but there is a small start. For areas where we work, there are some areas that are all covered in oil palm that we work. When we are doing marine work and we figure out how we're going to help, we ask them to buy books and dictionaries and for the schools, for the communities. Yeah, because we don't want them hanging around there. We want your money because you destroyed the place so you can buy the books, but we don't want you hanging around. There is one place called New Britain Island. West New Britain is all covered in oil palm. So studies have been done to say that the sedimentation from the oil palm is destroying and killing all the corals. The sedimentation is caused by lack of buffer zones, and the forest cover is out, and oil palm roots just keep going. They just spread out. And so all these places are covered. And then when we had rain, there's big flood that just comes down from the mountain and then just sweeps through, killing animals and maybe few people and pulling down villages and breaking all the bridges. The bay where they're trying to protect the shrimps, they used to have coral reefs with a lot of fish. But all the fish are gone because they have oil palm here, oil palm there, and the floods that are coming down with sedimentation coming down. So all those reefs are gone, so now we're working to protect the prawns. We're all working together with the government, so then there's discussion and agreement between USAID, PNG government, and then the NGOs can do the work and we can all share.
What industrial projects are looming for the future?
This is the same government that is agreeing to do all this conservation, and they're also signing an agreement to do all this mining at the political level. And so we're going to be the first country to be doing this seabed mining, and we don't know how that is going to be like. But all those little islands and even the mainland, it's all mapped out for exploration and mining. So they're seeing things like all the mountaintops, they have to mine first and they have to get gold out, and then they get silver out, and then they get copper and all the things underneath, so the big mountain becomes a hole in the end. And then they have liquefied natural gas. There's a big tank inside, and so they have several openings, and then there is also oil. And so the government agrees to take all those things out, and at the same time, we're talking about conservation. And so they are like among themselves, this is what the Minister for Mining is saying, this is what the Minister for Environment is saying, and then there is some kind of competition about who wins and who doesn't win.